This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Hello and welcome to Tuesday Breakfast. It's Tuesday the 3rd of March 2026 and we want to say thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. Yeah, in the studio this morning we've got Elena, Julia, Visa and myself, Juliet. So it's a fairly packed house this morning. How are you all going?
I feel like I'm still wet from yesterday's rain. It was so rainy all day.
Yeah.
That now, like, my shoes are a bit damp, and so I'm just
general dampness. Yeah.
It's all over.
Yeah.
And kind of a nice break, the rain.
Yeah, like, I was going to say, from all the mugginess, I feel like it was, like, pregnant with that rain, and then it finally just poured. I'm like, thank God. Yeah.
It's a really funny
way
of...
We talk about the weather a lot.
We talk about the weather, I think, every week.
It's important.
Yeah,
weather
because...
I think at 6 a.m. there's not much else to notice.
Yeah, our brain hasn't picked up much else. Fair. How are you? How was your weekend, Juliet?
Mine was good. I went to the beach, which was nice.
Lovely.
That's so nice.
Yeah. But it was like... 26 degrees, so it wasn't like super hot. It was like slightly chilly.
Yeah. And it's always cooler by the beach as well. Like, it's exposed. Yeah,
it is. And there was nobody there, which at first when I got there, I was like, is something wrong? What's going on here?
Is there a national emergency I'm not aware of? Well, yes.
Yes. But yeah, so it was nice. I took my boogie board. I was like, maybe I can ride a wave. There were no waves.
The air was very still. That was
That's true.
That's true. Yeah, that's part of the mugginess, I reckon.
Yes, I think so. But yeah, I think that we've got a pretty packed show today. So starting off, we're going to be listening to Kathy and Emma, who are members of Free Kanaki Solidarity NAM, who spoke to Fung about their campaign to raise $8,000 by April to pay for a Kanak delegate to come to so-called Australia to educate us on the ongoing struggle against French colonisation. And then up next at 7:30, we're going to listen to an excerpt from reporter Mel Chun from the Sunday Paper. Did a series reporting on the French state's suppression of the Kanak people following the uprising in May 2024. So this is an excerpt from that first episode of that series, which describes the atmosphere of state control and talks a lot about checkpoints and police violence. And then at 7:45, we're going to be speaking to Caro Dunbar, who is the lead of the women's team at Trades Hall. And we're going to be discussing International Working Women's Day, which is taking place this week, and what the meaning is behind that day, as well as the program of events that Trades Hall is running to celebrate this week. And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to be speaking to Elise Cunningham, the coordinator of the Better Buses campaign at Friends of the Earth in Melbourne. And that campaign aims to improve public transport, particularly across the western suburbs of Melbourne. We're going to talk about an upcoming symposium and what's next for the campaign this year.
And lastly, at 8:15, we'll be speaking to Suzanne Phoenix, who is a Melbourne-based photographer, about their upcoming exhibition all about International Women's Day.
Fantastic. And we might jump into our news headlines now.
These
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, 24 February, 2020. Sorry, Tuesday, 3rd of March, 2026. Fitzroy Stars netball players have been left traumatized after alleged racism endured by their players when without punishment at a tribunal meeting last week. On February 20, an opposition player allegedly made repeated remarks using the phrase "you people" before making noises and movements imitating a monkey or ape aimed at Stars players. The match took place at courts in McLeod. An independent tribunal panel found the opposition player not guilty. The Stars' witnesses were asked to reenact the incident. Fitzroy Stars president Auntie Esme told National Indigenous Times the players were traumatized by the experience. Established in 1973 out of the local Aboriginal community, and with ongoing primarily Indigenous representation throughout the club, Fitzroy Stars field football, both men's and women's, and netball teams in the Northern Football Netball League. Also in the news, in an interview with Tehran Times, Scott Ritter, a former UN weapons inspector and US Marine intelligence officer, stated that if there is a military attack against Iran, it's because the goal is to destroy Iran and eliminate the Islamic Republic. It is important to understand that when President Trump articulates regime change in the way he has, it reflects official US policy. Ritter has pointed out the duplicity of the US having negotiations with Iran to gain time whilst preparing for war and putting together in the US an alternative Iran regime to replace its current government. The independent and peaceful Australian network IPAN sees such a war on Iran as illegal and also assisting Israel in its desire to obliterate Iran. It would also continue the might is right actions of the US and continue perpetrating a human disaster which may well spread in the Middle East and beyond, said Mr. Derek Burke, spokesperson for IPAN. He added, there is no evidence that Iran has planned to produce nuclear weapons. Iran has signed the UN Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and has expressed its support for the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
In other news, the Brazilian government has revoked Decree 12,600 following a month of protest by local indigenous communities in the city of Santarém, Pará, in northern Brazil. The Luiz Lula da Silva government's decree 12,600 was published in late August last year, which allowed for the commercialization of the Madeira, Tocantins and Tapajós rivers as part of its national privatization program, which would benefit agribusiness and mining businesses. The decree would have legalized the destruction of the surrounding nature, including the ancient riverbanks, impacting water quality and exacerbating climate change. The Madeira and Tapajós rivers are vital to the diverse and dense ecology of the Amazon River. The government bodies who conducted this decree did not consult any of the 14 indigenous territories or hundreds of communities living in the nearby areas, despite consent being mandatory under the Brazilian constitution. The decree would have been particularly beneficial to Cargill, a United States multinational company that would have benefited from faster transportation of food goods such as soybean and corn. Protests included around 7,000 indigenous people blocking the only road to Santarém's airport, forcing the government to suspend plans to derege the Tapajós River. A month of resilient protests resulted in the federal government of Brazil revoking the decree from going ahead. Finally, in the headlines, February the 27th marks the National Day for the non-self-governing country, Western Sahara. Western Sahara remains on the United Nations decolonization list, awaiting a referendum for self-determination. In an interview with Green Left, Ron Guy spoke with Melanin Lacal. He mentions the European Union's hypocrisy in upholding Ukrainian sovereignty against Russian invasion based on the UN Charter, prohibiting the accession of territory by force, but does not protect the same justice in Western Sahara, continuously supporting the illegal Moroccan inhabitation. For many Western Saharan people, this feels like a double standard of international law only applying to selective geographic areas. Since Morocco invaded Western Sahara by military force, there's been a tolerance of the occupation from Europe, and many European institutions have entered trade agreements extracting national resources from Western Sahara without the consent of the Sahrawi people. There is a demand for the EU to choose a more neutral and legal attitude towards the Sahrawi Republic. Additionally, there's been a report of the use of armed drones by Morocco in Western Sahara. The recent drones have targeted mostly civilians, including Sahrawi nomads, Mauritanian and Algerian traders, as well as others travelling near the Moroccan military wall border. Melanin Lekal has powerfully stated, "No military barrier, no drone technology and no strategy of intimidation can permanently extinguish a people's right to self-determination." These have been the news headlines for Tuesday the 3rd of March. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
DigiChew, people, place, language. Connecting stories, culture and language across Australia. Contribute your content in digitube.com.au. Sign up for a free account and select your options for streaming, download and broadcast promotion.
A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and I'm joined now by Emma and Kathy, who are two members of Free Kanaki Solidarity Naam. Thank you both for joining me here today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I was wondering if you could each start by briefly introducing yourselves and how you got involved with the organisation. And Emma, I'll start with you.
Hi, my name's Emma. I'm a white settler based here in Naam. I guess I became involved with Free Kanaki Solidarity Naam as one of the founding members, I guess you could say. We actually, a bunch of us met at a rally that the Black People's Union, I guess, ran in the light of the May 2024 uprisings that were happening in Kanaki at the time. And so we realised that, yeah, we all had some connections over there, and we realised we could pull together those connections and, yeah, actually pull together some material support to support the feminists we know in Kanaki.
I'm Kathy, so I'm a Mauritian settler in Naam, and similar story to Emma, because we also one of the founders, and we met at that rally organised by the BPU. So, I'd been working with a group of feminists in Kanaki for a couple of years or something before that, doing interpreting to allow them to communicate with sort of English language speaking feminists around the Pacific. But it wasn't really any more activist than that. It it became more activist at the moment of the uprising in 2024, which is why the BPU organised that rally. And so the BPU have been a big part of the organisation ever since as well.
Great. And you're both here to talk to me today about a fundraising project that you've just started. It's to raise $8,000 by April in order to pay for all travel expenses for a Kanak delegation to come to so-called Australia. Emma, can you tell us more about this project and the proposed events that you have for this delegation here?
Yeah, sure thing. So we have a handful of Kanak feminists who'll be coming across. There's already an international conference happening here in Melbourne. And I think really they're already here for that. But what they're really hoping to get out of that conference partially is to meet other Indigenous Pacifica women. And we figured as well, well, while you're here, then it's actually a really great opportunity to publicise what is happening in Kanaki at the moment, particularly in regards to the recent waves of oppression from the French state, and just a way of getting that message across to people here, as well as, yeah, building on those Indigenous links as well, whether that's with, yeah, Pacifica women at the conference, but also really ideally outside of that conference space as well. Obviously, we've got really strong communities here in the Aboriginal spaces. We've mentioned Black People's Union already, but also, you know, other groups as well. We're hoping that, yeah, they can travel up north to Meganjin as well and, yeah, foster similar connections up there. So it's a pretty big trip at the end of all that.
Yeah, definitely. And so, like you said, the plan is for Kanak feminists to come and meet First Nations feminists here, but also other leaders and other activists working on the ground in so-called Australia. Kathy, I was wondering if you could talk to us about some of the similarities that you see between the struggle for self-determination, for justice, for freedom here and also in Kanaki.
Yeah, well, thanks, Fong. That's a really good question. There are so many similarities, you know, even historically in terms of the way that both countries were used as penal colonies, and also the connection with blackbirding of the Kanak people who were brought to Australia as slaves. So there are lots and lots of connections even historically. And then in the terms of the contemporary struggle, I guess in terms of the repression from the colonial state in both cases, even though it's a different colonial state in Australia, it's a, you know, essentially independent Australian state now, whereas in Kanaky, New Caledonia, it's the French state. There's still so many parallels in terms of the ways that First Nations people have been completely dispossessed of their lands. They've been subjected to genocide, which takes multiple forms, not just, you know, physical violence and killing, but also destruction of culture, destruction of language, the list goes on. You know, really high rates of incarceration of First Nations people in both cases. I think in Kanaky, it's something like it's over 95% of prisoners are Kanak, even though they're about 45% of the population. Yeah, so obviously similar vast overrepresentation to what we see in so-called Australia, just to give some examples.
Yeah, and something that I saw on the Free Kanaky page recently was the reporting of a Kanak man who had died in custody, who was held in a prison in France. So I was wondering either Kathy or Emma, if you could tell us more about that story. And again, drawing those parallels between colonial violence and state-sanctioned violence in both so-called Australia and at the hands of the French state.
Yeah, I think as Kathy said, really incarceration is just one of many tools of genocide, colonization and oppression. And we see so many parallels in the use of that, obviously, between here and also with the French state in Kanaky as well. So for a bit of context, what we saw with the May uprising in 2024, which was essentially, long story short, a push against the French state's attempt to dilute the Kanak vote. And then as part of that as well, we saw really, you can only really call it a kidnapping, where the French state essentially took a bunch of the leaders of that uprising, Kanak leaders, and shipped them off to prisons in France itself, so metropolitan France. And they did this without warning. Their families were not given any details as to when this was happening. And then not only these leaders as well, but they also shipped out a whole heap of prisoners that were already in Camp Est, which is one of the major prisons in New Caledonia, and shipped them off to France as well in order to essentially clear up space in that prison. And again, no warning given to their families. And of course, these people are over in France with absolutely no connections, support. And obviously the French state, when they do get released, they don't pay for the tickets home. And so you have this young man who is essentially caught up in this in a French prison in France, and who's then died at the hands of the French state. And unfortunately, this is not a unique incident. So that man's name was Frédéric Rochon. He is not unique in that sense, having, yeah, suffered at the hands of the French state in that way, because essentially, yeah, this is that ongoing tool that has been used for now centuries.
Yeah, and I think something that is also so terrifying is you don't really see any news, you know, mainstream media covering this. I think it's up to independent journalists and groups like yourselves who are reporting on what's happening to Kanak leaders and resistance fighters and people who are in the struggle for a free Kanaki, people like yourselves, but also journalists with the Sunday paper as well. So I was wondering, Kathy, if you could talk about the state of the media there and why it's so important for people in so-called Australia to keep a close eye on what's happening in Kanaki.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Yeah, I guess a bit like, you know, many other places, there's a range of different media sources in Kanaki. There's kind of the French state media sources, you know, some of which are more pro-colonial than others. There are the local colonialist media sources, which tend to be pretty extreme in terms of their rhetoric. And, you know, people who've been following our page might recall an interview that was conducted with Eric de Schumacher, who was until recently an academic in the law school at Melbourne Uni, who had expressed extremely colonialist views about both Indigenous people in this continent and Kanak people. So that's the kind of rhetoric that you find in certain segments of the media in Kanaki. But you know, there's also Kanaks who are doing, you know, media as well to a greater or lesser level of independence. But yeah, like we did see quite a bit of coverage of that May uprising in 2024 in so-called Australia, like, and people were sort of aware of it at the time, like, you know, the public generally. But for example, something that happened is that Uncle Coco up in Maganjan, Brisbane, actually did like a bit of a sit-in outside the ABC in Brisbane to try and force them to cover the events better. And what came out of that was the ABC signed an agreement with NC La Première, which is one of the main media chains there, that they would reproduce the New Caledonian news in English. So they're basically just taking the state version of the news, and then that's what the ABC is reproducing. So it wasn't at all what Uncle Coco was seeking. So we see the way that the colonial media just kind of twists the demands of First Nations sovereign people here, and is sort of applying that logic to another First Nations group in Kanaki as well. So that's why it's so important that we have independent journalists like the Sunday paper going over to Kanaki to be able to report on things from a pro-independence, pro-Kanak perspective to get those voices out there.
Yeah. To sum up, I'd love to bring it back to this fundraising project and your goal of $8,000. We've been talking at 3CR about the importance of mutual aid and the importance of actually just sending funds directly to those in the community who need it, who get to decide for themselves how to use those funds. So, yeah, how would you encourage our listeners to get involved, to contribute to this fundraising campaign? Yeah, where could people start?
So we have a Chuffed campaign, so an online fundraising platform that we're using at the moment. You can find that via our social medias. We're on Instagram and somewhat sporadically on Facebook. But yeah, we have already trying to plan out the events that are going to be happening. So we're looking at organising events for the end of April, early May. It's going to be a pretty back-to-back schedule. So we're starting off down here. We'll be Brisbane, Newcastle. So yeah, just keeping in mind that that will be coming up. And yes, any contributions to the CHUFT campaign will be absolutely amazing. Keep an eye out as well, because we'll be hosting also fundraising events in the lead up to that. So really any way in which you contribute, it doesn't have to be money. You can keep an eye out for the fundraising events that will be happening soon and see other ways in which you can contribute as well.
That was Kathy and Emma, members of Free Kanaki Solidarity NARM, speaking to Fung about their campaign to raise $8,000 by April. These funds will go towards paying for a Kanak delegate to come to so-called Australia to educate us on their ongoing struggle against French colonization, as well as connect with the decolonial First Nations elders and leaders across the continent. To find out more, you can go to freekanakisolidarity.narm. They have a CHUFT fundraiser going on at the moment, which you can find on their Instagram or by visiting our website after the show. Up next, we've got a song for you. This is 39 Femmes.
Listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and on 3cr.org.au. In September 2025, reporter Mel Chun from the Sunday paper spent 10 days in Kanaki, reporting on the French state oppression of the Kanak people following the uprising of May 2024, as well as their continued resistance and independent movement. In this excerpt from the first episode of the series, Mel sets the scene, describing the atmosphere of state control and talking to fixer Marie, whose name and voice have been changed, about checkpoints, police violence, and the legacy of settler colonialism. Thank you to Mel Chun and the Sunday Paper for sharing their reporting with us.
Kanaki was invaded by the French in 1853 and established as a penal colony. Nickel was discovered, and within a decade, mining was widespread. From there, it was the settler colony playbook: massacres, enslavement, imprisonment, reserves, protectionism, and then assimilationism in the 20th century. The 1980s saw a fresh wave of violence, with settler militias carrying out massacres and the indigenous Kanaks resisting with roadblocks, handmade weapons and stolen guns. This led to the Noumea Accords in 1988,
Kanaki est en train de naître,
which paved an institutional pathway to independence. But in recent years, the French state has become more reluctant to give up this strategic military outpost in the Pacific and created barriers to those pathways.
Où la Chine déploie une présence de plus en plus forte, où les États-Unis d'Amérique sont aussi de plus en plus présents, eh bien la France...
In May 2024, a new French law sparked a Kanak uprising and brutal suppression by the so-called forces of order.
French authorities declared they had regained complete control of the New Caledonian capital. But so far this week, the situation in Noumea has looked anything but under control.
At least 18 Kanaks were killed, and many more were jailed and deported. Since then, discrimination against the Kanak people has intensified in every sphere of life that the colony controls. Healthcare, housing, work rights, transport, education, and the justice system. This is what I'm here to report on. So today is the one-year anniversary of the murder of two young Kanak resistance fighters. They were 29 and 30 years old, and they were killed during a police operation that was searching for people involved in the May uprising last year. Tomorrow there'll be five in our party, two interpreters, a teacher, and another journalist, all activists involved in the Kanak struggle. I will anonymise them for this story. I have arrived early in the hope of attending a memorial service that will be held for the two young people killed. And I'm waiting for our fixer, Marie, to pick me up and take me there. I speak no French, so I'm out on a limb until the interpreters arrive.
English, sorry.
Hey, pardon!
Pardon!
I pass the day walking around town, along the coast walk past the trendy bars and upmarket restaurants that line the netted beach. I've been instructed to pose as a tourist, wear some pineapple sunglasses or something, my contacts told me. They believe they've had phones tapped, and on this anniversary of colonial violence, the French forces are on high alert. Day turns to night, and there's still no word.
So it's now 7:30 p.m. There doesn't feel like there's any indication that this is the anniversary of the killing of two resistance fighters. It's a Friday night, but the streets are pretty much dead. Everything kind of shuts down by 6 or 7 p.m. There are some Kanak people playing ball in the park and playing music.
Finally, at 8 p.m., Marie calls me.
They organize the custom, but also a march protest, but they were, they finished by violence. I was at my home and I didn't go to the custom.
Okay.
But I was at home and and some of my family called me by phone to explain what happened and so on. And I was prayed to Thank the good that I did not pick you up to go to this.
Okay, yeah, I understand. But I want to report on what happens.
Yes.
So don't be too afraid to put me in a dangerous situation.
Ooh la la.
Because it's important,
yes,
that everyone knows what is happening.
I understand.
But Marie makes it clear, without saying so, that she calls the shots, and she intends to protect us on this trip. The next morning, she picks me up from the hotel in an 8-seater tourist van. Marie is not what I think of when I think of a fixer. She's warm and motherly. Wearing a colourful mission dress, she greets me in the lobby, kissing me on both cheeks, and whispers, out of earshot of the white hotelier, "Welcome to Kanaki."
Let go of the handouts you clutch in your fist.
We drive to the markets for supplies before picking up the others. Marie has organised a picnic tomorrow with some prominent Kanak feminists that she wants us to meet, so she'll be cooking a feast. Manioc, or cassava, is an important dietary staple for the Kanak people. Post-colonisation, the French used to tell the Kanak people that eating manioc caused cancer, and that eating the imported, frozen or dried food was better for them. They used to be ashamed to serve manioc to guests because they thought it was bad for their health, Marie told me. In fact, the opposite may be true, with recent studies showing amygdalin extracts from cassava leaves had anti-cancer activity in cancer-prone rats. Now they serve it with pride, she says. On the way to the airport, Marie gives me some background.
Before I was in the political party, I left this party because so much patriarchy, too much bullshit decision.
She's a feminist and deeply dedicated to the struggle. She explains to me the tension between white feminism and Kanak feminism.
Custom life is important in our life, and we are between this traditional way and also the modern way.
Okay.
And for Kanak women, it's we usually mix the two way to make one decision.
Okay.
Sometimes Occidental way, they can't adapt, they can't understand, because they want us to choose one way only.
Okay.
I think they want to change me in white woman. I'm not a white woman. I'm Kanak.
Yeah.
And my life is with my clan, my tribe, and the rules of my tribe and my clan.
Okay.
But I have to mix the two way to be
complete.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then Marie tells me something that makes me realize the extent to which colonial violence has become normalized for the Kanaks.
Well, yesterday afternoon, a policeman from France killed a Kanak man, not in the south.
Yesterday
afternoon. But nobody, no media want to talk it. We haven't got the information that this man, this Kanak man, is already died. Because nobody has got the good information, because he shoot it in the head.
Later we find out from a local paper that the man did die. But just as Marie said, the story never made it into major news sources. Indigenous people are killed by police here on a regular basis, and there's rarely any justice. Marie points out the similarities to so-called Australia.
Our situation is very close to Aboriginal situation. Huh?
Yeah.
About colonization. Huh?
Yeah.
So the system of education, the church education, also the land was stolen by the white people, and also the policy to mix the indigenous people with the white race.
Genocide?
Yes.
Are these checkpoints?
Yes. Because we put another Kanak indigenous tribe.
Oh.
Across the mountain.
Past more checkpoints, Marie says they stop people from coming into the tribes. Her friend, in her 70s, was forced to walk for over an hour between tribes because of the checkpoints. She points out a brown troop carrier. That's the military. Instead of fixed checkpoints now, they drive up and down the roads between the tribes constantly. Just as she's telling us this, we drive past a checkpoint and Marie slows down. I shove the microphone hurriedly into my pocket and my heart races. But they ignore us.
We've been listening to an excerpt of Colonization of the Souls, a series of reporting in Kanaki by Mel Chun from the Sunday Paper. If you want to learn more about Kanaki and show your support, follow Free Kanaki Solidarity NAM on Instagram. You can also donate to FKSN's Chuffed campaign here, which goes toward food, medical supplies and legal representation for the Kanak people, as you heard from Kathy and Emma before. They are raising money for a Kanak delegation to visit. The Sunday Paper and podcast remain not-for-profit, independent, and listener and reader supported. The Sunday Paper podcast is compiled, mixed, and edited by Mel Chun, and Matt Chun is the executive producer. You can order issues of the Sunday Paper at slingshothotbooks.com, which we will link in the podcast notes.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Next up, we're joined by Caro Dunbar, the lead of the women's team at Trades Hall. Caro leads campaigns on issues related to women's rights at work, including amplifying the voices of women in male-dominated industries, raising awareness about gender-based violence at work, and advancing reproductive rights. And this Sunday marks International Working Women's Day. Caro is here to share the meaning behind International Working Women's Day and the program of events that Trades Hall is running to celebrate the week. And in particular, we're going to discuss the inaugural First Nations Women's Forum and the rally this week, which is part of the campaign for reproductive justice. But welcome back to 3CR, Carrick.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate you getting up early and coming on.
As always.
Particularly coming into the studio. But to start us off, could you tell us a bit about the meaning behind International Working Women's Day?
Sure. Well, International Working Women's Day has a radical history. So it's a protest movement born through women's organising for their survival, really, and for their rights at work. It started with a huge strike action in March in 1908 when 1,500 women garment workers walked off the job and marched through New York demanding shorter hours, better pay and voting rights. And right here in Melbourne, in NAM, actually, in 1882, 700 tailoresses, our own garment workers went on strike to improve their paying conditions and went on to form the first women's union in Australia, the Tailoresses Association. So this International Working Women's Day, we want to acknowledge that militant and radical action of working women and the union women who've come before us, and really redouble our efforts to campaign for rights and safety at work and beyond for women now.
Yeah, no, that's such a, inspiring and fascinating history as well. And, I was telling my friends last night, actually, about the interview we were doing and, a little bit about the history of International Working Women's Day, which you shared with us last year. So getting more and more informed each year. But, I think a lot of people don't know that history. So it's, really important to know kind of where the roots are. But could you run us through a bit about the program of events that you've got planned this week?
Yeah, very happy to. We're very excited about this week. We kicked off with an activist craft workshop last night. So that involved sign making, banner painting, embroidery, and a whole range of other activities to prepare for the rally. Acknowledging that women have often organised through arts and crafts. And so we wanted to acknowledge that. On Thursday, we're hosting, as you mentioned, First Nations Union Women's Forum. And then Friday, the main event, a statewide Union Training Day with a lunchtime rally for International Working Women's Day. So a really packed week this week.
Yeah, it sounds like a massive week ahead. And I love the interconnection as well of like hosting a craft workshop yesterday, which prepares you all for the rally on Friday. I think interesting to think about as well, that history of like craft being used in a radical and protest context as well. I know that this year is the very first First Nations Women's Forum. Can you tell us a bit about that forum and the space that it's aiming to create?
Sure. So this is really about providing space for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Union women to come together before International Working Women's Day. We have some staunch First Nations organisers, women organisers in our movement. And so the afternoon is going to be led by the First Nations Workers Alliance, which is a First Nations union organisation that fights for the rights of and campaigns for the rights of First Nations workers. So we really wanted to work with First Nations Workers Alliance and other women leaders in the movement to provide that space for them to organise, determine their priorities, and also provide an opportunity for women leaders to take action. So we're very excited about that and really excited to work with the staunch women at First Nations Workers Alliance.
Yeah, that sounds really exciting and, really great place for First Nations women to come together and also, develop those leadership skills and, have that sense of solidarity. And then I know, later in the week you've got the Union Training Day International Working Women's Day. Could you tell us a bit about that training day and what that's going to involve?
Of course. We're very excited about this. It's also the first time we have done this. So on the day, we're going to have more than 250 union women a training with their unions on this day. So that's massive. We've had some significant wins to improve our rights and safety at work and to progress towards workplace gender equality. So everything from winning new rights to flexible work arrangements, having more tools in our toolkit, our legislative toolkit, to end gender-based violence and sexual harassment at work. Of course, we've ended the use of non-disclosure agreements for workplace sexual harassment, and unions have also won more powers to bargain collectively. But we know that all of these rights that are intended to advance and accelerate gender equality are only as good as how well they're being used on the ground. So our goal for this International Working Women's Day was to bring together women from across the movement. Of course, there's union women in every industry and occupation in Victoria. Bring them all together, educate them and grow their skills to be able to address and intervene when there are issues at work, and really build their power through that sense of solidarity that comes from having hundreds of women in the same place at the same time. So yeah, we're very excited about that. And of course, all of those women and many of our allies and comrades will be coming to the rally at 12 p.m. on the same day. So very excited about this opportunity to really build the collective and make those connections between women in the movement.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it'll be such an really useful event for union women to come together from across a lot of sectors as well and learn from each other. And I think it's so important as well, that idea of, you know, there's been a lot of wins recently and, you know, changes to legislation, but if that's not communicated to the people, then you might not actually see those tangible impacts on the ground. So I think it's so important, yeah, the work that you're doing to communicate that and make sure that people understand how then they can use that to their benefit. You mentioned the rally, which is taking place at midday on Friday during the union training day. But yeah, could you talk us through the theme of this year's rally and what the rally is going to look like?
Yeah, so the theme of this year's rally is building collective power. So I think that goes to the day that we're hosting as well, which is that training day to build our, you know, union delegates and workplace leaders skills. There are so many different campaigns being run, and so many different women at workplaces across the state fighting for their rights and their safety at work. So we really want to spotlight that at this year's International Working Women's Day rally. I mean, just last week we had 1,500 early childhood teachers walk off the job, Australian Education Union members walk off the job to fight for better pay, reduced workloads and better conditions at work. So, you know, that's just one example of women in every industry fighting for better. So we're going to be highlighting those stories and spotlighting the union women who are leading those campaigns at the rally, which is, yeah, super exciting.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned to me off mic earlier that you were actually going to have Gia was going to be giving a speech at the rally, who joined us on Tuesday Breakfast couple months ago. What was Gia going to be speaking
about? Yeah, very exciting. Gia is an amazing delegate and health and safety rep. She's going to be talking about the Rail, Tram and Bus Unions It's a Bloody Mess campaign, which is about being able to access toilets. So many workers, particularly workers in historically male-dominated industries, are unable to access toilets and facilities that they need to be able to work and be safe at work. So she's going to be talking about that, which is going to be fantastic. It's a great campaign, a national campaign by the Rail, Tram and Bus Union. So just one of the speakers will be there for the day.
Yeah, exciting. And I know that Women's team at Trades Halls has been really focused on the reproductive justice campaign this year. Could you tell us a little bit more about that campaign and some of the developments that are coming up?
Yeah, so there's actually going to be an action at the rally about calling for 10 days of paid reproductive health leave for every worker. So we know that no matter your age, gender or your sex, at some point in your working life, you're going to experience a reproductive health issue. So for many people, that might be dealing with menstruation issues, dealing with menopause, endometriosis, and of course for men as well, it can be prostate issues. And we know that one in six couples face challenges with infertility. And so there are so many different ways that workplaces need to step up to support workers during their working life. So this campaign calls for 10 days of paid reproductive health leave, in addition to other leave entitlements, and also the right to request flexible work arrangements to deal with a reproductive health issue. We've been amazed by the positive reaction to this campaign. It's a national campaign being run by unions around the country and the Australian Council of Trade Unions. And we've already seen across many different industries and workplaces, unions bargaining for these rights. And so we want this enshrined in our national employment standards to be accessible to every worker. So yeah, it's been a really positive campaign, and yeah, we know that so many workers, particularly women, have struggled with these issues, and it's time for, you know, our modern workplaces to recognise and understand how we can make work work for us, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I really love, yeah, just kind of the inclusivity and all-encompassing nature of that campaign as well. That, and I think that really is expressed through the title of the campaign, which is escaping me right now. What's it called
again? For Everybody is the name of the campaign. And it really is. So we've seen a couple of cases in Queensland where male workers have been diagnosed early with prostate cancer because they've been able to access prostate checks through through this leave, but yeah, we know that it will absolutely assist women to manage reproductive health issues at work, but it really does apply to all workers.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it would be such a positive change across the board, so yeah, it seems a bit like a no-brainer. But yeah, maybe to step back to the big picture, could you talk a little bit, Caro, about why it's important for women to join their unions?
Sure, my favourite topic. I'm really proud to be union. I think every union member should be proud to be union. Union workplaces are safer, they're more respectful, they're more stable and secure, and women in union earn substantially more than women who aren't in their union. And I think really importantly, what we're doing with this International Working Women's Day as well is bringing that sense of solidarity, sisterhood, community and connection to women as well. Many women, particularly in male-dominated industries, might work and be, you know, one of the only women at their workplace. And so unions, through our connections and through other workers in the movement, can come together and share and make people feel less isolated. But really, there is power in union. We've seen that through substantially more workers being covered by enterprise agreements, particularly in female-dominated sectors, which is seeing wages grow. Our employer pay gap data is out today. So 5.9 million workers are able to access and see, if they're at a major employer, what their pay gap is. And so we're seeing also a reduction in the gender pay gap through a lot of these changes that unions have fought for. So yeah, encourage every worker, and particularly every woman worker, to join their union.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I think that sounds like a really fascinating piece of data as well. I would be interested to read it myself. But yeah, if 3CR listeners do want to find out more about this week's events and more about the Trades Hall women's team in general, where can they go?
Yeah, so you can go to weareunion.org/equality or weareunion.org/events, and also encourage everyone to follow the Union Women accounts on Facebook and Instagram, so union_women, and you can get all of the up-to-date information there as well.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Caro, for joining us today. We really appreciate your time and, yeah, finding out all about the fantastic events for International Working Women's Day.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Well, we've been speaking to Caro Dunbar from the women's team at Trades Hall about International Working Women's Day, including the meaning behind the day and what events Trades Hall has planned to celebrate this week. And we also spoke about the campaign for reproductive justice as well, and yeah, other important information such as why you should join your union as a woman or gender diverse person. And I think that's all we've got time for today for Caro's interview, but thank you so much.
Up next, we've got a song for you. This is Spinifex Gum featuring the Malaria Choir.
Bye.
Be listening to Gonna Lily by SpinFX Gum featuring the Marlia Choir.
Up next, Elise Cunningham is coordinator for the Better Buses campaign at Friends of the Earth in Melbourne, and this campaign aims to improve public transport access across the western suburbs of Melbourne, fighting for environmental, socio-economic and racial justice. And Elise is here this morning to discuss the upcoming The West Deserves the Best symposium that Friends of the Earth is running, and also to discuss what's next for the campaign this year in a state election year. Welcome back to Tuesday Breakfast, Elise.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. To start off, Elise, could you maybe summarise what the Better Buses campaign is for listeners who might not have previously heard about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Better Buses campaign is run by the Sustainable Cities Collective at Friends of the Earth Melbourne. And we've been campaigning for coming on 4 years now for a transformational network reform of the buses in Melbourne's western suburbs. So if you look at a map of the bus routes at the moment in the west, it looks like a crazy bowl of spaghetti. Buses take four times longer than a car trip to get anywhere and are just really inefficient. In some areas, they come every 40 to 50 minutes. And the result of that is that people don't have public transport that they can actually use, and car dependency is really entrenched amongst communities in the west. So what we want them to do is to transform the network into more of a grid-based network. And in the early days of our campaign, we worked with researchers at the University of Melbourne who mapped out what it would look like to redeploy the existing networks onto that grid-based network, and found that buses could be coming every 10 minutes using the existing sort of spending, the operational spending on buses. So, yeah, we've been working, we're a grassroots campaign working and organising with communities in the West to sort of build their own capacity to campaign around the issue. And we do, yeah, we've been doing a bunch of like community events around the elections and budget cycles and things like that. And yeah, I guess that's a good summary. I suppose just to say as well, our kind of powerhouse of our campaign is the collective, which is majority unpaid collective members who are passionate about public transport and climate justice and community from the western suburbs as well.
Yeah, awesome. And yeah, I think, yeah, that's just astonishing to think about. Yeah, you said that the bus journeys take four times as long as the as a car journey in the west. Yep. If you want to get around, that's just wild. And yeah,
that's
just
if
really
they show up at all.
I know. Wow. Yeah. But yeah, that just really does discourage people from being able to use public transport. And yeah, it just seems really counterintuitive as well when you know, perhaps it would be a lot of communities in the west who would need to be able to use buses due to it being less expensive than cars, but that's just not accessible or possible, which is just so frustrating. But I know you spoke about wanting to build capacity for the movement, and I know that at the end of the month the campaign is hosting a symposium, the West Deserves the Best symposium. But could you tell us a little bit about this symposium and what it's hoping to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess for a bit of background, you know, over the years, our organising, you know, we really focus on drawing on lived experience and local knowledge and storytelling around the bus network and how this issue is impacting everyday people and how it impacts their everyday lives. And, you know, over the years in conversations with people, we've realised that there's just so many intersecting community issues that something as simple as better buses could really help to, like, alleviate in such to some degree. So that's things like, you know, safety, gender justice, like, you know, for example, there's a courthouse out in sort of Wyndham area where the bus stop out the front, the bus only comes every 40 to 50 minutes. So we've heard cases where, like, someone's in the court for, like, a family violence trial and they've had to wait at the bus stop with the person who used that family violence against them. There's, you know, the racial justice element, I think, in, I guess, how the community's kind of segregated, and I guess the inequity across, like, the western suburbs that are a super diverse place with, like, a lot of new migrant families moving in compared to other more affluent and whiter parts of Melbourne. And, you know, cost of living is obviously the really big one at the moment. Like, in a lot of places in the West, car ownership is also, like, much higher than other parts of the city. So some families will have three cars, maybe even more. And you can imagine, like, how much that is costing people out of pocket for petrol and, you know, just the cost of running a car, whereas if you live in an affluent community, you're more likely to have, like, accessible public transport. So, yeah, it's really entrenching that inequity that it's just not acceptable in 2026 or ever, really, that this is the situation in our city. So, yeah, we wanted to really, like, bring people together to tell that story. So for the forum on the 28th of March, we've been working and, like, doing a lot of engagement with sort of local grassroots community groups, social service sector stakeholders, so like Gen West, West Justice, Brotherhood of St. Lawrence and others, to kind of engage them and bring them into the fold and, like, hear their stories of how people who access their services are impacted by this kind of historic and current underspending on buses and infrastructure and services, and really, like, build a movement towards transport justice. So that's kind of the summary of, like, what we're aiming for. And we really want to be kind of drawing out what the community wants to do at, like, local, state and federal levels. Like, obviously we've got an election this year, so we're hoping to kind of come up with some really clear state asks, as well as, like, engage people in some training that we're planning to do later in the year to prepare community groups to self-organise towards the election.
Yeah, very exciting. And, yeah, it does sound like it'll be a good opportunity to, yeah, build that capacity and bring people together with that shared purpose as well. And you touched on the election is coming up this year here in Victoria. But, yeah, if you're able to, would you be able to share, some of the, maybe the focus of the campaign, what that'll be this year and, maybe some of the demands that you're going to have on, the government going into this election?
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, our overall kind of demand remains the same, which is, like, we want a significant investment in a transformational bus network reform. That's, like, going to remain our kind of big key ask. But what we're planning to do sort of off the back of the forum of the symposium on the 28th of March is engage local people in the community organising trainings that will run probably through, like, April, May and June, to build their capacity to, like, come up with their own ideas and their own kind of strategies working towards the state election, because I guess, like, we have some bigger kind of things planned, but we also don't want to be too prescriptive in what, like, local groups want to do in their own communities. But in the middle of the year, there is we did an action for this, I think, last year as well, or maybe the year before, but in June will be 5 years since the state government released Victoria's bus plan, which has some, you know, it's kind of vague, but it basically does say that they want to transform the bus network. But it's been 5 years since that was released, and we're not seeing any, like, substantial reform. And a lot of the announcements that have been made over the years, even in the West, are still really in line with that, like, piecemeal kind of approach. So middle of the year, we'll definitely be doing some bigger actions around that and really holding the government to account for their lack of action. And then, yeah, I guess towards the election, it's likely, we haven't fully fleshed our plans out, but it's likely we'll do sort of candidates forums and things like that. As well as, like, part of our strategy last year was working with the local backbenchers to kind of build their support for the campaign. And, you know, they're all hearing from their communities constantly that buses are a big problem. And, you know, have been a lot of the backbenchers in the West have told us that they're, you know, supportive of bus reform, but it's something that they're not yet saying publicly. So we really want to build the pressure to get them to say that publicly and put pressure where the decision making actually lies, which is with the Premier and Cabinet. And, you know, like, Jacinta Allen used to be the Minister for Public Transport, and we know that she cares about public transport as well. So we're going to really try to, gun for the commitment before the 2026 election.
Yeah, well, it sounds like, yeah, there's definitely a lot of work to be done, but that there is that kind of maybe, underlying interest and hopefully motivation to make change as well. If
we hope so.
Yeah. In terms of if our listeners want to find out more about the work of the campaign and the Sustainable Cities Collective more broadly, where can they go?
Well, you can head to our Instagram, which is @better_buses. You could also head to our website, which is based in the Faux Melbourne website. So that's www.melbournefoe.org.au/transport. You could also just come along to one of our collective meetings, which are every Wednesday at 6 p.m. And the first one of the month we always hold at Ross House, which is in the city, just to make it a bit more accessible for people from, like, all across the city. So we'll have a meeting tomorrow. If people just want to pop by, you're more than welcome. And then usually our meetings are at the Faux office in Collingwood and online. And we always welcome people to just kind of show up and get involved, because, yeah, we need, you know, we've got, like, part of our plans this year as well in terms of our organising strategy are going to be literally, like, getting out on buses, talking to community members and bus drivers on the bus where the problem is most prevalent, and really engaging them in building these, like, local action groups. So we really need all the engagement and organising capacity that we can. And I will say, you don't have to be from the West to, like, get involved with this. Like, obviously, there's nothing about us without us. Like, the work is best done with, you know, community who have that lived experience. But I think everyone should feel like they have a stake in this campaign, because at the end of the day, transport is one of the fastest growing and the second highest source of emissions in the state. And it's really about building equity across our city and, showing solidarity with communities in the West that are experiencing this issue that, you know, those of us living in other parts of Melbourne don't have to deal with.
Mm, definitely. And, I love that idea, both, nothing about us without us, and having the community really driving this campaign, and of course to have people invested from other parts of the city as well, because it impacts us all, when it comes to transport emissions, and we should all be striving to have a much more equal society. So thank you so much for joining us this morning, Elise. We really appreciate your time.
No worries at all. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We've been speaking to Elise Cunningham, who's coordinator at the Better Buses campaign at Friends of the Earth in Melbourne. And you can find out more on Instagram at better_buses and also at melbournefoe.org.au/better_buses_campaign. And they hold their collective meetings on Wednesday at 6 p.m. each week.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersects where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
Next, we'll be speaking to Suzanne Phoenix, a Melbourne-based photographer, about their upcoming exhibition held at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre. Within her work, Suzanne uses a unique visual lens to emphasise subjects who are often underrepresented. Today, we will be discussing her creative process along with her influences and personal connections to International Women's Day, which is this coming Sunday, March 8th. Good morning, Suzanne.
Hello.
Hello, good morning. It's so nice to have you on the show.
Sorry, I don't know what's happening there yet. Thanks for having me on your incredible show.
We're so glad to have you. I'd love to know all about your creative practice, and when did you know that you wanted to pursue photography?
I photography is just always a big part of my family's, a big part of my family. My nana photographed all the time, and it was just really instilled in me that photography was important and important to document people and place. And I think that was just part of me from a very young age, and I have always photographed. And then after about 13 years ago or so, I thought, oh, maybe I should take it a little bit more seriously.
Yeah.
So there was no grand awakening, I don't think.
Yeah, something you've known all your life.
Absolutely.
What are some of the inspirations behind your work, and what is your process for choosing your subjects?
For International Women's Day?
For International Women's Day and for your practice in general.
Sure. So for International Women's Day, I really... I just went to work one day, and I was working in a neighbourhood house, and all the women were dressed up, and I was like, what's happening? And they're like, oh, I dress up for International Women's Day, we always do. So I started taking their photos then and asking them what the day meant to them, and that was the genesis of that project. I didn't really think it would become what it's become. And over the years, I've just, I have a list of when I see people, system trans women and gender diverse people who I'm really inspired by, or I think do amazing work, or just very, whether they're emerging artists or they can be, anyone who I just sort of think they just sound amazing. I want to meet them. I want to take their photos, and I'd love them to be part of this process or this project. And then I just reach out and see if they'll say yes, and I'm continually surprised at how many people say yes.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And when you are planning these series of photographs or preparing for an exhibition, what kind of planning goes behind the construction of these photos?
There's a lot of planning. I suppose I try each year, because it's a, I deliver this by myself and it's all self-funded. But it's a good 6 months of the year. When I'm in it, I'm in it. And I need to plan everything from, doing the communications and asking people to be part of the process. There's a lot of people to manage within that. Each year there's usually, between 20 and 25 people. I've got to manage, some of the logistics on where to photograph people. And sort of 2019 was when it became a little bit more organised, is what I would say, but I was still photographing all of those people in the car park in Collingwood. And then over the years it's become, I needed more a more controlled environment to have, be able to do that in some kind of studio setup. And there's the logistics around where to possibly exhibit or how to present those photos to the world, and they're written, and everyone's written response. And there's been a variety of ways of doing that, including, as you know, for Queen of Women's Centre, there was an exhibition there last year, and there'll be one again this year. And I've done events with the people involved at pubs, like Brunswick Ballroom and Hares and Hyenas, and I've done street paste, paste up of the photos. They've been on Bakehouse, the billboard there on Punt Road, and every year's a bit different. I quite like it. It's a bit dynamic. It feels a lot more the process, right, as it's come to this year, is much more, it's a lot smoother at the moment. Yeah, it's become smoother over 15 years, yes.
Yeah, I guess you learn a lot along the way.
Absolutely.
And this upcoming exhibition, as you just said, marks your 15th annual portrait series for International Women's Day. Speaking of starting out in, like you said, the Collingwood car park and where you are now, what are some of the most important things that you've learned about yourself and your practice along these last 15 years?
Important things I've learned about myself. I think about, you just never know if you don't ask. So learning to put myself out there, I suppose, is learning to ask it's a bit of just take a deep breath and send that email to Casey Donovan or Janet from Spiderway. Just do it, and you never know. Because there's also that you have to get really good, I think, as a photographer and artist as well, also at hearing no as well. So that becomes that kind of rejection, rejection as well is a... you just don't take it personally, so not to take things personally, I suppose. And what else have I learned about myself? I've learned so much in this process. It becomes so much a big part of my life. And then, just relationships are really important as well, and collaboration, how you work with people, how, for me, consent and collaboration are really important. And the process I go through with all the subjects is a collaboration, and they get decision-making you know, they get to make the final decision on the photo as well, which is not the norm. It doesn't happen a lot of the time. What else have I learned about myself? I'm a workaholic.
Oh, yeah.
I've learned that. I've got better at that. But, yeah, it's a big project. And, I suppose the ability to do things by myself, but also, you know, I have a huge amount of support. So the people who support me in the project and being really grateful for that and how you manage those relationships and how you build community around a project and, yeah, a lot of things.
Yeah, and it's incredible the community you have built amongst all those who are collaborators or who work with you, alongside you, or even the people that come and see these photos and take that with them. You've built such a community over these past 15 years, which is something that is really, really inspiring and really impressive. But yeah, finding balance, experiencing rejection, I think those are definitely skills that we could all work on. But yeah, just to wrap up, could you explain a little bit about what International Women's Day means to you personally and how being a woman influences your own work?
Well, I'm just going to talk about how being a woman influences my work. I suppose hugely, I think being a woman, how I grew up, the experiences I've had, all of those things influence how I see things and how I engage with things and people. And I don't know how else to say. It's just it's a huge driver for me. And, when people ask about, what do I want to achieve? I want to create and put out into the world positive, strong and real photos of women and gender diverse people. Like, that's my driver. And that comes from being a woman. I want to make change. I want to, try to influence change, I suppose. And when all the, all the horrible things that happen, that I feel so lucky to have this project for International Women's Day, because I go, well, what can I? I think a lot of us, at times, we feel a bit powerless and how to make change and how to react to the things that happen around us, and the patriarchal society that we live in. But I feel so lucky to have this project where I get to put all my energy into that and say, well, the way I can try to influence change is through the International Women's Day project.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the show today to talk about your exhibition. It's been great speaking to you this morning.
Thank you so much. Your show is just amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we've been speaking to Suzanne Phoenix about her upcoming International Women's Day project at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre. This exhibition will be held from March 4th to April 15th at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre.
DigiChew, people, place, language. Connecting stories, culture and language across Australia. Contribute your content in digitube.com.au. Sign up for a free account and select your options for streaming, download and broadcast promotion.
A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and we've had a very busy show today. So first off, at 7:15, we started listening to a clip from Kathy and Emma, members of Free Kanaki Solidarity in Naam, about their upcoming fundraiser. Then at 7:30, we heard from Mel Chun's reporting on the ground in Kanaki from the Sunday Paper series. At 7:45, we spoke to Caro Dunbar, lead of the women's team at Trades Hall, about International Working Women's Day and the meaning behind it and what's coming up this week in terms of Trades Hall's events. And then at 8 o'clock, we spoke to Elise Cunningham, coordinator of the Better Buses campaign at Friends of the Earth, about the campaign and their upcoming symposium at the end of the month. And then finally at 8:15, Elena spoke to Suzanne Phoenix, a Melbourne-based photographer, about an upcoming exhibition held at the Queen Victoria's Women's Centre. Quickly, our events calendar for the week. So on Wednesday, 4th of March from 1 to 5, there's the First Nations Women's Forum at 54 Lygon Street, Carlton. On Friday at 6 p.m. at midday is the International Working Women's Day Rally at 45 Victoria Street, Carlton. On Saturday at 7:30 is the IFTAR fundraiser for Ghazan families at Schoolhouse Studios in Coburg. And I think that's all we have time for, but thank you everyone for listening.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.